Look out. Look outside. Look outside. Have another hit. The purple and indigo.
Thanks.
So, I guess my initial approach in addressing this question about poetry is kind of a demonstrative one. Poetry is this. Or this is poetry at least. Interesting, those are two different things. This is poetry. The example I'm setting around from the book To See the Earth Before the End of the World by Ed Roberson. I don't know how people are familiar with Ed Roberson's work, but certainly I think throughout his career, and especially in the three volumes that came out in the last decade, City Eclogue, To See the Earth Before the End of the World, and the New Year of Avalon. There, in my mind, that's accomplished an example of what poetry can be as it is anywhere. And I just want to talk a little bit about how I see that answer developing in the example I'm giving to you. So, poetry is a lot of things. And we were talking last night, kind of Jess and Lisa and me, about poetry as comedy. Poetry as comedy. I think for today, I'm thinking about poetry as play. And as, in particular, the kind of play that discovers that play within that.
He was listening to us.
Play gives what it gives back, its resistances. I'm also, especially over the course of the day, coming to think more and more about poetry as synesthesia. And I think this is something that Ed Roberson really attuned to as well. Synesthesia in the narrow sense, the blurring of boundaries between sensory modalities, seeing colors, that kind of thing. And more generally, as the blurring of boundaries between artistic disciplines. This is the topic that Jed Rasula addresses in a recent book that's been fascinating me, called The History of a Shiver, and she argues that modernist writing comes, it draws essentially from the attempt to become music, and thinking about Anselm reading in the literature of painting or acting music. All these related disciplines that both are and aren't poetry. I think, in particular, what comes out in the bit I'm about to read to you is the way in which poetry is austere in ways that some other art forms are not. But, what you're given to perceive can seem like everything, but it's also printed words on a page in whatever arrangement they are. And that's a fact that any poet ends up grappling with. So poetry, the play of language, and in particular, I think one sort of fundamental character of language that gives it its play and transmits that play along to us is something like what the logicians talk about as the duality of intention there is a past, and extension. The internal web of meanings that makes language able to signify at all. And then it's extensionality, the fact that it points out to the actual fact and possibility, right? That both of these things intermingle in the linguistic realm, and I think that the poetry can be a profound place to examine that intermingling. So without further ado, I'm going to turn to the beginning of chromatic sequence series. And just read a few pages of this. So this is a fragment from a much longer piece. This is a serial poem composed of 13 sections, with several subsections as well. Chromatic sequences. One, form in early movies, flickering leaves in the outline of the canopy, color lost as if each lethal light were a dart of flame off green, gone ashen to the sky, each leaf a page smoke, the distance each page has come to history, the haze of each past raises its shade of dust, each veil its valley of living, the distance between it and the next like tree rings, the steps as much an aerial as mortal perspective, the trees bend in sequence, the eye watches thin air, but sees the wind. What color photographers call the magic hour. The colors of light arrive as a time of day, saddening the whites only. Formal or not, the torch of film caught up with changes, and American color photography was invented with blood. Everything turned golden brown, dun in the low sun. The cities burnt. Two, we were not seeing movement. The frames put belief each time in a different place than we remember seeing it before. We were not seeing movement. The frames were slower than we could ignore. What looked like time were measures taken. There were no steps except in place, where place was taken, as happened to have got that moment's seat. Taken from there to here, there was no movement between them. We were seeing. It was only seeing we saw, making live what we saw. From that viewer, in that seat, I never saw till now anything up to now, until now, that maybe I haven't seen anything I've seen, but the betweens, lined up the moon, the hills of the horizon, the stretching fields, the riverbank, trees, river, the road all going different speeds, and at some time between them, they even change and go different directions than my moving now and the foreground and back when this is was beautiful, even in between. About the trees bending as a scene of the wind, I use this sighting all the time. The clearly see the wind is now clearer there in its footsteps than I see marble or wing-footed bronzes flying, than the look of movement, see its alias, the invisible man filmed, would have only a crushing of snow afoot, such passing through nothing, such crushing of surface, onto quarries and to cities, such crunching of light, the present bent, lensed into this moment, we see everything moving out of sight. Three, chromatic spatiality. Recall the car, the eight people cramped inside, the large landscapes of talk and excitements often in the wrong lane, working by faith and innocence, both in which we innocently had so little faith, proceeding through the closing openings in traffic just in time. Beside the road, recall someone had set the sapling of a small bright willow in the huge space eventually its grace would take, and how the color of it that spring already filled. I think I'll stop there. And just say a bit about how I see at the level of the word, at the level of the sentence, at the level of the image, Roberson putting the language into play. I'm going to start just at the level of the word, the word's color, for instance, and the word chromatic, which is clearly an important one, it's in the title. They're multivalent, they're multiple in their meaning, and this multivalence is part of what makes this poem which is trying very hard to move, makes it move. Chromatic is an optical term, right, color, but it's also musical. It refers to the half steps that afford the complexity of music like Duke Ellington's, which shows up later on in this poem. Anyway, it's a good question. Why do we call half tones chromatic in music? It turns out it comes from the old Greek chroma, which meant visual color, but the Greek theorists of music, because they thought that the half tones were just decoration, tone colors. And they're blues tones. And so from the title at the very top, Ed Roberson is alluding to the musical color that's inseparable from the experience of color in America, and not just alluding to it, but joining that tradition with the way his verse is ending the word. There's nothing black and white about color in America, except maybe in the movies. And he's playing very adroitly with the line between black and white and color in the visual stereo. We start out watching a black and white film that turns into color. Of course, we can't see it, because all we can see is the words. But he makes you see green in the first section. Right? He takes away the green of the leaves in the black and white film, leaving them ashen, about to burn. But the green doesn't just vanish from the poem, it comes back a couple of seconds, the last section I read, the color of the sapling in spring, the green that fills the space of the tree to come, right? The tree that's just imagined by the landscaper who leaves room for it. And you know, I will say to Cassie, I think that tree is what in high school they would have called a symbol, and actually a symbol of hope. And I think one of the things that makes this poem really remarkable is that you can use that sapling as a hopeful symbol, and it's not hokey at all. Now the setting of the sapling brings up one other motif that runs through the poem, that of what's visible and what isn't. What makes things visible? Light, in the first instance. What do you see? How do you see it? The wind in the trees, just the trees moving. Later on, in the section I didn't read, there's a child who's learning what's modern in an art lesson, learning that modern art is about closely observing what you see, attending to it. And what he sees, so I actually didn't read it out, but I'm just going to call your attention to the next page at the end of there. I'll read the last bit. Earliest of those purely observed, what I felt only myself see by the third grade was meat in the butcher shop. Pig's feet, the skins looked like my seat partner's hand, and I felt this sadness for her. She was ugly, and she wasn't supposed to be being white. It was my secret that I could see it as meat. And supposed to be, really looked at. And I just want to draw attention for a second to that supposed to be really looked at, which is one example. I'm going to close in a bit with another one of his, of the way that Roberson really subtly twists or plays the syntax of his sentences in order to generate the largest ideas. There's a real fractal quality to his writing, you know, that you can attend to any one word at the same time. There's an immense scale going on as well. He was trained as an earth scientist. I think that sense of the landscape, sort of zooming in and out of the landscape, is always present. But so it's supposed to be really looked at. You know, our ideas light up the intelligible world like light lights up the physical. Ideas about how things are supposed to be tell you what's what. And what Roberson sees at this point is that how things are supposed to be around here are not how things are supposed to be around here. And that's the tension, that's the horror behind the poem. I mean, the book as a whole is driven by even as it's rich in imagination, there are two facts or two conditions that it's returning to. One, the history and the present of race as it's lived in America, and the other, what's going on with the climate. And I'm going to finish by drawing attention to the last page I gave you. This poem, To See the Earth Before the End of the World. And I'm not going to take the time to read it, but just because we may be running low on time. But there's one sentence in the second stanza that, again, I just think is brilliant and awful. The mile ago it takes to stop the train. And the complexity of the tense there, right? That's the way that the tense. Time is registering space, right? It takes a mile to stop the train, and maybe that mile's already passed. That's one of the very few moments where in the book, which again I think is often illuminated by hope and the possibility of language's play. There's a sense also that actuality maybe taking over possibility, and that in fact that mile ago was already passed. That's your note. Thank you.
So for the past several years, I've been doing a prose about reading poetry. So I was pleased to be asked to talk about what is poetry. Pleased and terrified. I'm a rational person to be. But I happen to have been giving these issues some thought and trying to put them into torturously trying to put them into readable prose. The book's coming out next summer, and it's called Why Poetry. And in the book, I try to give in to the impulse to answer very simple questions that people ask about poetry, and that we should be asking. I thought about what Anselm said, he was talking to Joshua, he said sometimes the best, most productive questions are the simplest ones. I immensely agree with that. And what is poetry is that kind of question. And in the course of writing, I had an instinct that really why would be a better question than what. Of what seemed to get me involved in a lot of cul-de-sacs of conversation that ended up not being helpful, but why, trying to ask myself if there was a central impulse in making poetry that you could trace back through time and across cultures was interesting, potentially futile. You can judge it if you read the book, but an interesting kind of intellectual project to try to do. So the other thing I'll say is that because I'm going to be bourgeois Jew, I am trained to do what I'm supposed to do. Because this is about form, the little thing I wrote is about form, so I'd like a little praise for that. my mom and daddy aren't here. I'm calling this a micro talk. I had said here to like sort of distill things from the book called micro talks. And then in a panic, I thought, well, maybe that's already something somebody's already used. Person already does, and so I googled it on my phone. It turns out that the only thing I can find is that there's a very sophisticated walkie-talkie system called the Micro Talk Cobra. So I think I'm okay. Anyway, so this is a micro talk, and it's not very long. It shouldn't take very long to read. Most poets I know hate and love being asked what poetry is. In an attempt to be helpful, I'm going to share with you my go-to response, which has the advantage of being interesting and also coming originally from the mouth of a French poet, which thereby gives it an unearned and undeniable authority. In Poetry and Abstract Thought, Paul Valéry writes, a poem is really a kind of machine for producing the poetic state of mind by means of words. Yes, that seems correct. He goes on to say, if the term machine shocks you, if my mechanical comparison seems crude, please notice that while the composition of even a very short poem may absorb years, the action of the poem on the reader will take only a few minutes. In a few minutes, the reader will receive his shock from discovering The poem makes poetry happen in the mind of the reader or listener. It happens first to the poet. In the course of writing, the poet eventually makes something, a little machine, one that for the reader produces discoveries, connections, glimmers of expression. Whatever it does, it can do it again and again, as many times as we need it, which is what is good about machines. The creation of the poetic state of mind in poet and reader is inextricably connected with form. A poem, literally, makes a space to move through. To read a poem is to move through that constructed space of ideas and thinking. When this is working, the mind of the reader might go in a more or less easy or uneasy unison along with the poem. This can be an odd, exhilarating, disturbing experience, like being haunted or possessed. When the associative drifting way the thoughts and ideas move in the poem takes over our mind and makes us feel troubled and reassured, changed, and also more of ourselves. As we think along, we start to make connections and have experiences and feelings we might not have otherwise had without the poem, or maybe we would have had them in a different time, in a different way. To read a poem can be a kind of impossible communion with someone far away in time and space. The truth is, I always feel a little fear at the silent nothingness that exists when I want to write a poem. Faced with the emptiness of the page, it can be hard to start saying anything at all. Yet it is the silence itself that draws me into speaking. I feel a silence around each word, a necessary absence that I want to maintain, because I feel to drown out that silence, to block it, would be to forget or ignore something I feel certain I must not. This is, I'm sure, why I'm a poet and not a storyteller. For me, that silence, that nothingness, always needs to be there along with speaking. In a poem, we feel what is there, but also what is not. What is not there is brought so close to us that it makes us all more alive. That's my day, by the way. This is something akin to, but far darker and more dangerous than the beautiful insufficiency of prayer, the pleasurable ache of being brought as close as possible to the divine and always falling short. The silence at the end of a broken line is one of many characteristic visual and oral reminders of the presence of silence. There's the space and silence that surround the title of a poem, the way the title comes out of nowhere, and often doesn't immediately suggest what is coming next, can remind us of how weird language is, and how close to meaninglessness we always are. This effect of the title surrounded by silence is exacerbated by the leap to the first line of the poem, which more often than not is more obscure and elusive than in other forms of writing. The form of the poem, and again, I realize that, by the way, just an aside, I'm talking about a kind of more traditional looking lyric poem, I understand that, but I'm doing it. I think it can be extrapolated to other forms of poetry, like something we can talk about other ways, like Anselm's poems and Joshua's. The form of the poem is pervasive spaces, refusals, or withdrawals at the end of lines between the stanzas, reminds us of nothingness. There is silence, too, in the leaps of metaphor and symbol and rhyme and association that remind us of gaps in thought, all the ways poetry sometimes behaves like all other forms of writing, but can at any moment say no to all the usual functions of language, its association and movement as a form of content, the way it refuses to do what it is supposed to do. Wittgenstein wrote that what we cannot speak about must be passed over in silence, maybe. Or maybe what we cannot speak about can only be conjured in poetry through the mechanism of negation. This is existential negation is only possible when one chooses to write poetry, saying no to all other purposes, to bring us up as close as possible to silence, absence, nothingness, so that we can start to feel what it means to live our lives so close to the abyss. It is, paradoxically, only when we truly start to feel that nothingness, that absence, that the meaning particular to poetry can emerge. Language leaps, possibly and essentially, across the inescapable void between name and thing. Words always retain an anarchic, vestigial, latent element of that leap. When, at a particular time, one person decided to call something something, a name. However much we take language for granted in everyday life, using it, we are always close to its tenuous nature. Nowhere else but in poetry, in both its content and its form, are we made so constantly aware of nothingness, the void. To bring us closer to that void is something close to the central purpose of poetry, what defines it as a genre. It has to do with making meaning in the face of silence without succumbing to it. And the way I understand form is not as something decorative, placed on top of a message or idea. That is a description of propaganda or advertising. Form is the machine that makes the necessary perception of poetry possible. Without form, there would be no poem, which would be sad. And I'm going to read one poem that I wrote. I think sums all of this up way better than I just did. Have you ever been to Lake Tahoe? It's very cold. I was teaching up there, and I spent a week blah, 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 lying about poetry. And along the way, I made a mistake. And promised that I was going to go swimming in Lake Tahoe at the end of the week when you all gathered there, and I was sort of stuck doing this. And it's a very bad idea. It's extremely cold to go in there. So just heads up. Okay, so this poem is a short poem that's about the consequences of that experience. It's called Poem for Coleridge. The lake was super fucking cold, and with every smallest increment got colder, I plunged my head under no sound, not even extreme silentness, no stupid ideas, no words of comfort I should not or not have not said, not my constant, horrible, ungrateful desire to have different form or be done. All this talking, not even breath, everyone was really gone. There is no word for that X. Under, it outweighs time. Later, on shore, wrapped in a white towel and still feeling ridiculous and also a little secretly proud for having so mortally scared myself, I would say some mystical, inexorable communion feeling toward those ancient blue waters pulled me, meaning I had already forgotten. I was, as always, already talking too much to keep away something numberless.